Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me today is Simon Lambert. And coming up, size matters. How big should your emergency savings really be? Almost 80% of potential first-time buyers don't have enough savings for a deposit. Simon offers some pearls of wisdom. We explore how to make the step from saving to investing, and the dream age to retire is 62. But reality is somewhat grim for most. So how do you sort out your pension if it's falling short? Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news just to go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
I'm Lisa Kaplan from Charles Stanley Direct. I spent 15 years helping people understand their finances with clear, jargon-free language. People often ask me whether they have enough to retire, what to do about inheritance tax, or how best to invest. Often, it's a simple question that one of my expert team can answer straight away, and we would love to help you too. Contact us for a free 15-minute chat at coaching@charles-stanley.co.uk. Investment involves risk.
But first, savers could need up to £50,000 to have a sufficient emergency savings pot depending on their age and circumstances. So begins Helen Corain's article on the subject. The generally accepted idea is to have 3 to 6 months' worth of essential expenses set aside should the car fail the MOT or you lose your job or some such thing. But Simon Lambert, £50,000. That seems a lot. And it seems a lot to hold in cash, especially when we've just come out of a cost of living, high inflation, really rubbish savings rate environment. But be that as it may, let's go through Helen's article here. Where did that figure come from? And how much do you really need in your emergency savings pot?
Right. Let's explain that figure, first of all, the very big figure. But there will be some people, even those potentially listening to this podcast, for whom even if they were putting 6 months' worth aside, they'd end up hitting that £50,000. But there'll be others for whom that would be a crazy amount. So the rule of thumb is to have enough cash to cover 3 to 6 months' worth of essential expenses in an emergency savings fund while you're working. But there's another rule of thumb which suggests in retirement you need more, 1 to 3 years. Now, I don't know whether that is entirely accurate as a rule of thumb, and I don't know whether rules of thumb are designed to be entirely accurate. But from my perspective, if you were in retirement and you were in receipt of the state pension, then that's a guaranteed income. You're going to be getting that. So if that's going to be covering quite a lot of your essentials, do you need to be having 1 to 3 years put aside? What is it that you are kind of budgeting for in terms of an emergency fund? Well, I guess there is that thing where it's if people have to go into care. That's the problem. So people worry about that. They worry that if I have to go into care in later life, what's going to pay for that? And that's where all of a sudden those costs will balloon. But this very much depends on the rest of your financial situation. So, for example, if you were somebody, for example, in their late 70s, you got a state pension. Your partner's got state pensions, if your partner's still alive. You've got a defined benefit pension, which a lot of people of that generation will have. And then you own your own home, which a lot of that generation will have. There's a number of things that you can fall back on. So state pension, defined benefit pension, those two things can't be taken away from you. And if you've got your own home, you may possibly be able to draw on the value of your home, potentially if you need to, through something like equity release. So it might not look as bad as the picture paints it. But I think this is more about, you know, that's a kind of outlier. We talk more about, you know, people who are working still and their emergency savings pot. First of all, what's it for?
Well, I was going to say, because I wouldn't have put paying for care in an emergency savings pot. I would have thought that's something that you should probably have saved for somewhat separately.
Yeah. And I think so we should take this 1 to 3 years of retirement emergency savings pot out of the question. That's right, where the £50,000 comes from.
Yeah.
There were, as I said, there will be people listening to this for whom £50,000 is actually the number that they need, because that, you know,
school fees or something like that. Or?
Well, exactly. 6 months worth of essential spending for some people who are high spenders will be £50,000. But for most people, it's considerably less than that. And in fact, basically, this research says households spend on average £2,058 on essentials each month. So the cost of 3 months worth of essentials for the average person is $6,174. Now, that's the average person.
Mm.
In my case, for example, my mortgage is more expensive than that £2,058 just in itself, without any of the other essentials, without the feeding, you know, heating,
all living, those other, yeah, surviving,
those nonsenses that you have to pay for. Yeah. So I'm already above that number, but other people might go, well, I'm well below that number. That comfortably covers me for the essentials. But your emergency savings pot is for a couple of things. So firstly, it's for if something goes wrong that you need to pay for. The boiler breaks, the clutch on the car goes, those kind of things. The things that all of a sudden, unexpected expenses that crop up, and you need an emergency savings pot that you can draw on for that, so that if something like that happens, you can A, get it sorted, and B, you don't have to start borrowing money to fix it. And I mean, there are lots of people who don't even have the money to cover those kind of small emergencies. Your emergency savings pot is also then there for the scenario where you lose your job. You don't have any work. You're unable to work. You get sick and can't work. You lose your job, or you might be self-employed. There might not be any work going at that point. And it's to tide you over for that period of time. But how much you need and how many months you need will depend very much on your personal circumstances.
Yes. And when you bring in the losing your job, for example, I mean, that could be huge sums. But then aren't you talking about sort of protection insurance?
Well, most people, protection insurance is a good thing. Most people don't have it. Most people should consider getting it. If you talk to financial advisors, they will tell you that protection insurance and income protection insurance, you know, in its varying forms, is something that everybody should be taking out. But the reality is that people don't, and it feels expensive.
Is it worth it?
Yes, it is worth it, and is definitely worth considering. And the things that you can look at to make it cheaper are also the same things that you can look at when considering your emergency pot and how big it needs to be. So firstly, are you employed? If you're employed, which most people are, how long is your notice period? How good is your sick pay? The length of your notice period and the quality of your sick pay will help define how long you could be off work before you need to start drawing on your own money. So if you're on 1 month's notice, then you're probably going to need to err towards the side of the bigger emergency savings pot than someone who's on 3 months' notice. And if you're on 6 months' notice, then you can probably go a little bit smaller. Is your partner, if you have one, employed? Does your partner earn more than you, less than you, around about the same as you? If your partner, let's take the example, earns around about the same as you, and they're also employed, and they're also on 3 months' notice, well, you can probably work on the basis, you know, these things do happen, but you can probably work on the basis it's unlikely that you'll both lose your jobs at the same time. So can you rely on their income? They've got the backup of the 3 months' notice anyway, so if something bad did happen. So can you rely on their income to tide you over while you go try to find another job? How easy is it going to be for you to find another job? And how willing are you going to be to take any job if you can't find another job that you want? These are things you need to factor in. Then you've got the, what are your other expenses? Is it just you? Is it just you and your partner? Have you got kids? If you've got kids, they are expensive, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Have you got a mortgage? Have you got rent? How big is your mortgage? How big is your rent? These are all things that you need to take into account. And then you go, okay, do I need to go closer to the 3 months? Do I need to go closer to the 6 months? And then you need to work out how much that money is. And I think the thing that freaks people out when they hear this is they hear 3 to 6 months, and then they multiply their monthly salary by six and go, oh my God, I could never have that much money in an emergency savings pot.
Mm-hmm. You haven't even mentioned self-employed people as well.
Well, I'll go on to that in a minute.
All right.
But then you go, okay, well, hang on a minute. Firstly, it's post-tax. So it's not your monthly salary. It's your monthly salary after tax and after national insurance and after pension contributions. And then it's not even all of that. It's your essential spending. And this is where we need to go back to something we've talked about a few times on the podcast recently, the budgeting thing. So I would sit to work this out, right? I'd use the 50-30-20 rule thing that we've talked about, where you've got 50% on essentials, 30% on wants and desires, and 20% that goes on to savings. I wouldn't necessarily do the 50-30-20, but I'd do the process for working out the 50-30-20, which is where you take all of your spending over a month, download your bank statements, do it with a highlighter and a pen, or put it in a spreadsheet, or do something fancy, whatever you want to do. Do it over a couple of months as well, because you might have one month, might be a bit of an outlier, but just get a rough idea of where your money's going. So how much is essentials? Okay, so that's, you know, your mortgage, your utilities and heating, your food bills and stuff like that. And then how much are you discretionary and so on. And you can work that out and go, right, these are my essentials. This is the stuff I need to cover. And then chuck a little bit in for the, you know, wants and desires kind of thing as well, to give yourself that buffer zone, because you will want to spend some money on something, probably might want to take away at some point. And then you've got the number that you need, the absolute kind of minimum number that you need each month. And then you multiply that by your 3 or your 6 months, depending on where you fit on the scale. And that gives you the figure. So that's going to be much, much lower than the freak out number, the 6 months of your salary kind of thing. And if you are self-employed, obviously you don't have the benefit of the notice period, the sick pay, all those other things. And you might have a tax bill that you need to settle as well. So you then need to factor that stuff in and work out, okay, I'm probably going to need a bigger emergency savings pot than somebody who is employed, because I don't have those things to fall back on. But then also think about, like, well, hang on a minute, what about my partner? You know, so in our example, in my household, I'm employed, my wife is self-employed. So, you know, she's got me to fall back on in that sense. I need to be a bit more wary because I have her to fall back on, but mm-hmm. she's self-employed and her work is not guaranteed. So one of us can fall back more on the other one who's employed than the other way around.
My situation at home is the other way around. But yes, exactly. There will also be people, and I've covered stories of this, where they do have lots in savings. And we're going to get on to when we'd make the step from saving to investing a little bit later on. So we don't want to go over that too much. But is there a danger that you could keep just too much in savings? Where should you be keeping your money? How much is too much to keep in cash? Is there such a thing?
Well, the general rule is that you want it in an easy access savings account, somewhere that you can instantly get at the money, because, you know, you might need it. Now, again, on your personal circumstances, you can play around with this a bit, because do you need all of it to be instantly accessible, or do you need some of it to be instantly accessible and then a backup pot somewhere that is perhaps not so accessible? Mm. So, for example, do you even need to keep it all in cash? I mean, a financial advisor would tell you, yes, you definitely need to keep it in cash. The most sensible course of action is, yes, you need to definitely keep it all in cash. I'm going to tell you now that I'm willing to take a bit more risk on stuff. So I would say, I don't necessarily need to keep this all in cash. I could keep half of it in cash and I could keep half of it in my investment ISA, but know that I would have to draw on those investments. But those investments might be down when I need them. So then I'm going to have to draw on other investments. And this could be bad financially for me, which is why a financial advisor would tell you that I'm an idiot and you should keep it all in cash, because I could end up compounding the issue that I've given myself.
Yeah.
But I might personally be willing to take that risk. And this, right. It comes down to like the same decisions you're making on what you invest in and things like that. It's how much risk are you personally happy with? So the first place I would say is keep it in cash. And if you're going to keep it in cash, what you want is a cash ISA. And this is where our good old friend flexible cash ISA comes into play, right? Flexible ISA, you can take money out of it, and as long as you put it back in within the same tax year, it doesn't count as that year's tax allowance. And the great news is that the best ISAs that you can get on the market right now happen to be flexible. So one of them got improved yesterday. CHIPS 5.1% ISA now accepts transfers in. Plum has a ISA that actually beats that and pays 5.17%, but that's got a one-year bonus on it. And also you're limited to the number of withdrawals you can make in that year before the rate drops. So I don't think that's at the best there. Zopa pays 5.08%, or did the last time I checked. Again, that's flexible ISA, that's decent. You could even go with something like Trading 212, which pays 5.2% and is a flexible ISA as well, but the FSCS protection is spread between a number of banks, and so it makes it a little bit more complex for people, but could still be a good option. But to get a flexible ISA, keep your money in an ISA, because then you don't pay any tax on your savings interest. And that's important, because the more likely you are to need a big emergency savings pot because your earnings are higher, the more likely you are to be paying in tax on your savings interest. So that makes it even more important to have your money in an ISA. So keep it in there. If you need it, you can draw on it, and then you can put it back in without using some of your ISA allowance.
Talking of ISAs, Simon Lunn, I just teed it up a second ago. Let's go to reader question time, because it's a fairly long question with essentially rather a simple point, is how to make that step from saving to investing. So your reader has 15,000 in a cash ISA, they save £600 a month, blah, blah, blah. Now what for them? Take up the story.
Well, it's the question of, you know, at what point do you move from saving to investing, and how do you do that? Yeah. And so there are people who will have built up large sums of money into cash pots. They've got their emergency fund, they're saving every month, and they go, okay, you know, how do I start investing now instead? The ideal scenario would be, if that's your emergency pot and you're happy with that, you just leave that be, and then you start diverting some of the money that you're saving every month into an investment ISA instead. So say, for example, you know, in this case, we've got somebody who's saving £600 per month. Now you might want to say, okay, I don't want to completely ignore my cash savings and my emergency savings fund, and I don't feel comfortable doing that. So you could say, right, I'm going to keep £200 going into my emergency cash savings. And in this instance, the person has their mortgage payments about to go up in about a year's time. Oh, right. And they want to be able to maybe have a buffer zone for that. And then you could put £400 into regular monthly investing.
It's important to point out that they are saving into a pension. That's happy. That's to one side. Yeah. So if anyone's listening going, oh, were they paying into a pension? Tick that box. Yeah.
They've ticked that box. They're doing it through their workplace pension. They're maxing out their workplace pension to get their employer's contributions, which is what you should always do. If you are employed, you should be doing that. Again, to go back to the self-employed, if you're self-employed, your pension is your responsibility. So you need to be factoring in the money that you should ideally be paying into a SIP every month, and just forget about that. Just keep doing it and forget about it. But yes, if you're employed and you're able to save £600 a month, which is a lot of money to be able to save a month, to be clear, keep £200 going into your emergency pot, put £400 into regular monthly investments. You could change that. It could be 100 and 500, could be 600 into the investments, could be 300 and 300. It's up to you. Again, you need to make the decision about how you do that. And the easiest way to do that is you open up a stocks and shares ISA account with any of the top platforms that you can find at thisismoney.co.uk/platforms, where you can read our review of the best DIY investing platforms. And they will make it very, very easy for you to sign up. And then the best place to start is to just go for a really simple, broad, global tracker fund. These can be super, super cheap. And you can invest all around the world at a very, very low cost. So for example, you could pick something like an ETF. We've literally just published our 50 of the best funds and investment trusts roundup, where we ask experts for their top ideas. And in there, we've got some examples of some of these funds. So as a tracker fund, there is the ETF, it's the SPDRI shares, MSCI ACWI ETF. The kind of gobbledygook that you encounter here. I know. And ETF investing is meant to be so simple for people. The acronyms, the names.
Say that again.
SPDRI shares, MSCI ACWI.
Now say it with some speed. ETF.
Anyway, the important thing you need to know is, this is an ETF, an exchange-traded fund, which invests all around the world with a total expense ratio of just 0.2%. So you're paying 0.2% a year to invest all around the world. It's got 65% of it set in the US. The UK makes up 3.3%. and it's the third biggest holding behind Japan, but it also invests in emerging markets. So you end up with a bit of China, a bit of India, a bit of other emerging markets, nice and simple. Or you could go for a fund like the LNG International Index, which gives access to companies around the world, and that's just 0.13% the charges on that. Or you could go for something like Vanguard's Life Strategy Range, which is a way of investing in a mix of shares and bonds, and you choose that depending on your risk. So you could go 100% shares, you could go 20% shares. The bonds are there to be the safe bit, the shares are there to be the more risky growth bit. The thing people need to be aware about is that's not a pure global tracker fund. It's slightly skewed towards the UK. But any of those things, and you will find on investing platforms that they have selected funds lists, they have core funds lists, they have funds that they recommend to just get started, they have model portfolios and things like that. And those are the kind of things that you can just go, right, I'm just going to start putting my money in there and I'm going to get used to it. And if I get more interested in the future and I want to pick different investments, I can do that. But just start getting my money in and I get used to it. I start to, you know the feeling, and every month I do it. And that's how you shift from that sort of saving to investing.
That's it for part one.
I'm joined today by Lisa Kaplan of Charles Stanley for our weekly Investing Explained feature. Lisa, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, Simon.
We have a question here. What should I consider before moving from saving to investing?
The big difference between saving and investing is the fact that with investing, although you hope to do better with cash savings, you are taking a chance that you may do worse. So over the long term, you want to do better than cash. And usually that's what happens, but there's no guarantee. But along the way, it's going to be choppy. And you've got to be both willing and able to deal with that. So what's your personality like? You don't want to sort of be dismayed if your investments have fallen, as they will from time to time. You've got to be willing to stay the course and feel comfortable staying the course. Otherwise, you'll sell at the wrong time. And the other part of that is you've got to be able to bear that loss, because if you're aiming for a particular thing, a big purchase in a few years' time, and then the money isn't there because it's a bad time in the market, then you're not able to bear that loss. And those are the two things I talk to people about.
And so somebody in the position who's doing this, should they use a stocks and shares ISA?
Yes, definitely. It's just good housekeeping. I mean, there are other tax advantaged things like pensions, which can also be considered. But if they're not using the ISA, it's really straightforward. You're going to make money, hopefully, in terms of dividends. So that's sort of a form of income tax that you'll save in an ISA on the dividends. And also, if you're sort of buying and selling within a portfolio, you might have capital gains tax, which you won't have in an ISA. So those are sort of the tax considerations, but also there's just sort of an administration consideration, is you don't have to do a tax return to account for your dividends or your capital gains because they're wrapped up in an ISA, so it's very tidy.
As somebody who has recently sold some shares and had got capital gains that I have to work out over the years, I can agree with you on that one. I wish they'd been in an ISA for admin's sake.
And every year you get another 20,000 allowance that you can use. I mean, so it builds up and it can make a real difference as well.
Lisa, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure.
Welcome back. From saving for emergencies to saving to get on the property ladder, it is grim out there. Only 1 in 8 potential first-time buyers can afford the average starter property in their area, and almost 80% have insufficient savings for the deposit. High house prices, increasing living costs, insufficient savings, rising rents, mortgage rates, all of that have combined to push home ownership out of reach for many young people and less young people. That's according to a study by the owner of Skipton Building Society and analyst at Oxford Economics. So what can be done about it? Simon, firstly, the research. Is it more grim out there than it's ever been? Sounds pretty rubbish.
In a sense, yes, because what has made the picture grimmer than it was in recent years, which was already a pretty grim picture for people trying to get onto the housing ladder or climb up the housing ladder due to high house prices has been the rise in mortgage rates, which has compounded the issue. In theory, eventually, the rise in mortgage rates should make things better because it makes it harder for people to borrow large sums of money, which is why it's making it grim at the moment. But by making it harder for people to borrow large sums of money, you start to put a lid on house prices. You start to squeeze house prices, and house prices have come down a bit, not a lot. People expected them to come down more than they have done. But, you know, they're not shooting up anymore because people just don't have access to those funds. And actually, that's probably, it's a bigger lever that can be pulled to stop house prices escalated than just building many, many more homes. And there's research on this. The Bank of England did it. So look it up, basically, if you want to. It's not saying that we don't need to build more homes, but it is saying that a lot of the problem that we have is due to cheap, very cheap money over the last two decades.
Yeah.
But the situation is such that even those earning over £71,250 a year, the top 25% of earners, if they were an individual, it's important to note that. Right? Even among those, only 56% still cannot afford to buy their first home in their local area. So, but many first-time buyers do not buy as an individual. I believe it might be the majority of first-time buyers, but I'm not going to say that because I don't have the statistics in front of me to back it up. I'm pretty
Google search.
Yeah. So, and it's joint or individual income. And the point at which people could buy their own home by themselves, that ship sailed quite a few years ago. Most people now rely on doing it with somebody else, doing it with a partner, which, you know, is a problem. That's a societal problem. Yeah. And so with the combined incomes, then they could potentially do that. But you'd be talking, so say you take that 71,000 number and you divide it by two to get two people on the median income, that is, adds up to that number. And even then, two people on the median income, most of them couldn't buy a home in their own area. So yeah, it's not great. It's pretty bad.
I couldn't find the statistic, Simon, but I did find some Lloyd's research from 3 days ago, so very current, that said almost half of first-time buyers are considering buying a property with a friend or sibling, which actually is probably a slightly healthier than sort of forcing couples together early to buy a property that, you know, friend or sibling.
It's always considered a high risk scenario, that, because it's
more than a partner.
Well, the friend one is considered a high risk scenario. I think the sibling maybe not, although people's never underestimate people's ability to fall out with their siblings or argue with them. I mean, you know, even as adults, we can do some really good arguing with our siblings, can't we? And I say that as one of four. But the buy with a friend thing is considered a risk because you're more likely to end up with two wanting to go your separate ways at some point, and often at a point where one of you wants to go their separate ways because they want to buy with it. They've now got a partner and they want to buy with the partner or whatever, and the other one doesn't necessarily, the situation suits them and they don't want to go their separate ways yet. And then it becomes very difficult for the remaining one to buy out the other one who wants to leave. So they both end up having to sell, which is no bad thing because actually that might be good. But that then one friend gets to move on with their partner and the other friend is stuck there going, I can't afford anywhere to live now because I don't have another mate to buy with or a partner. So, but actually, I suppose you could look at it the way that you've just pointed out is quite a good one, is you're less likely to have a messy breakup than you are with someone you've got together with a year ago.
Exactly. I just find it under so much pressure. I've fallen down a rabbit hole now of looking for statistics and can't find the right one I want. But I was intrigued by almost 2 in 3 first-time buyer mortgage quotes were to those applied using the title Mr. 2/3. That's a lot, isn't it? I'm sorry, I can't find the one that you want. And I can't concentrate on that many things at once. I'm afraid, dear listener, you're going to have to do the research yourself.
This will give you a reason to come. Give you a reason to come back next week, okay?
But
other than all the other reasons we're giving you to come back next week, if you come back next week, I will furnish you with in-depth first-time buyer statistics.
Yeah,
promise.
Oh, can't wait. Honestly, I bet they can't wait for that. So also this research though, let's try and
don't make that a reason not to come back next week.
Yeah, I was gonna say we won't promise it. The hardest to buy, this looked in the heart, Ed's piece looks at the hardest to buy. Obviously, you'd imagine London and the southeast. Are there any other places that we don't know of that are really hard to get on the first time ladder, first time property?
East of England's quite hard as well. Yeah. Right. And then obviously the southwest is a major issue for people who are from the southwest because you've got a lot of holiday homes in parts of the southwest. Got a lot of prices being driven up by second home buyers, and you have a lot of jobs that don't pay great money because they're in the hospitality industry and stuff like that, and can be quite seasonal. You know, that's not to say that that's the whole of the southwest, but there are pockets of the southwest where it is very, very difficult for people. And that's it's true of like other places as well. Like if you were to go to, you know, somewhere like the Gower in Wales, stuff like that, you know, parts that are very popular. I was reading something about one of the Scottish islands as well a while back, you know, where basically it's not, obviously it's impossible for people, actual locals from the Scottish island, to buy because you've got quite a lot of second home ownership and a very limited supply of homes, but it's almost impossible for them to rent now as well.
It's amazing. I mean, you're reading what's going on over in Spain at the moment. I can imagine people in places like Cornwall are thinking, I mean, I don't know about hosing tourists, restaurant dinners and stuff, but, you know, I imagine there's some people very frustrated. You do have, let's be practical here, Simon, you do have the first-time buyer's step-by-step guide, as you would expect, on your comprehensive website. Obviously, we won't go through the whole thing. It is extensive. So do go and have a look if you are wanting to get on the property ladder or you know someone who is, pass it on. But a bit of a pricey of it, Simon. What's some tidbits from your own experience of life?
Well, this first-time buyer's guide is a very comprehensive guide written by Ed Magnus, and it's basically everything you need to know as a first-time buyer. So if you want to find it, go to thisismoney.co.uk/mortgages and you'll find it on the page there. But it talks people through what they need, you know. So the deposit. Deposit's very important. The bigger the deposit, the better. But saving a deposit is the hardest thing for most people because, you know, they're in the scenario where, say they're buying a £200,000 home and someone says, right, well, you need a 10% deposit minimum. And that's not a particularly big deposit. Most first-time buyers buy with a bigger deposit than that. It's 20 grand. Saving 20 grand will take a long time for most people. You have to do some seriously hardcore saving if you are on the kind of average wage that people in their late 20s or early 30s are on to get to £20,000. And even then, you only get yourself to your 10% deposit. But say you can get yourself to your 10% deposit, then you need a mortgage. So you're going to borrow £180,000. This is where this thing called loan to value comes into play. Loan to value basically measures how much of a deposit you're putting down versus the property's price and how big a mortgage you're getting. And it's measured in the percentage of the mortgage. So you'd be getting a 90% mortgage. The rates on 90% mortgages are not as good as the rates on 85% mortgages, which are also in turn not as good as the rates on 75% mortgages. And if you can put a whacking great 40% down and get a 60% mortgage, you'll get the best rates. So it is worth considering, if even if you can raise that 10% deposit, can you get some kind of other source of funds that could tickle you over the extra 5%? You know, is there a member of family that you could potentially tap up? And the bank of mum and dad, the bank of gran and granddad, are one of the biggest contributors to the first time buyer housing market in this country due to the high price of property. And I would say, if you are the bank of mum and dad or the bank of gran and granddad, you might not like this, but you know, if you can, then do it. Do them a favor, help them out. And if you are a first time buyer and you could potentially get that help, don't be too proud to take it. You know, so many other people are doing it, even if it's just a bit of help that helps you get over the line. And if you don't have access to that help, then, you know, you have my utmost sympathies, because it is that help that is managing to get most people over the line. And so it's a very unlevel playing field, and, you know, the system is broken. But, you know, there is other help that you can get when you are saving. I would say if you're under 40, get yourself a lifetime ISA. Right. Because you put your money in You get a top up from the government of 25% on top of what you put in, up to a certain amount. And, you know, do not turn down a 25% instant return on your money, because you won't be getting that many other places other than a pension where your money is locked up until you're going to be at least 57. Be wary of some of the criteria of the first time, of the lifetime ISA, around the fact that you have to be a first time buyer. For example, you can't get the money out in an emergency without facing a penalty. There is a limit on the highest value of the home that you can purchase, and that is catching people out, for example, if they're buying in places like London and so on. But, you know, other than that, it is fundamentally a good leg up. You need to budget for your other buying costs, stamp duty, conveyancing, then the other costs of ownership, maintenance and furnishings. You know, it does cost money to run a house. I know that there will be lots of people who think their landlord doesn't bother to spend a penny on the property that they live in, but it does cost them money for that property to keep going. And when it's your own home, you probably look after it a bit better as well. So if a tile blows off, it's on you. Home insurance, you should also very much consider life insurance, especially if you have a partner or independence. And then once you've found a property that you like, it's a good idea to get a mortgage in principle. This helps you make offers because it shows that a lender would be willing to lend you X amount. It's not a guarantee they will, but it will show that they will. You can do this really easily by going to thisismoney.co.uk/mortgage-finder, where our mortgage partner, Ellen C, will take you through the process, show you how much you should be able to borrow, and consort an agreement in principle. Making an offer, we've talked about this before, that we could do a whole podcast on making an offer, but, you know, make an offer. Don't just pay what they're asking. Read some of our articles on making an offer. Applying for a mortgage, you want to try to have your finances in order before you do this. So if you're thinking of buying a property, start getting your finances in order 6 months to a year in advance. Don't like make an offer on a property and then go, right, I need to get my finances in order. You should have done that a while ago. So I should have said that at the start. And then hopefully, you know, then it all goes ahead. You've made your offer, your solicitor does the conveyancing, your mortgage goes through, you exchange contracts, you complete, you move in. Welcome to life as a homeowner.
You know what, Simon? I think I got asked the question by someone who was young, and it goes back to the moving in with a partner. They said, oh, but, you know, how can people afford nowadays to buy if they don't move in with us? And I was like, firstly, don't risk your kind of future happiness and tie yourself to someone you're not interested in, or you may not be, just to buy a house. I didn't buy until the tender age of 42, which was about 3 months ago. And I'll be honest with you, Simon, I didn't mind renting. If this rental system, you say the housing market is screwy, the rental system is an absolute joke. I really hope whoever's in government, we know who's in government now, but sorts that out so you have security and actually own it. You know, from renting, I managed to travel around the country, I even traveled around the world. You know, I've had landlords who were rubbish and didn't do a lot, but I've had amazing landlords who did loads of stuff. Now I've got, you know, the kitchen sink, it's slightly broken. There's marks on the wall. And I'm thinking, I have to do that? I didn't get any help from my parents. I was saved up. I didn't need to have a partner to buy. Okay, I was a little bit later than everyone else, but I did it and I'm proud. And that's okay. You know, it's not going to be easy. You know, not everybody has to buy a house at 26 or whatever age. So all I say is whatever you decide to do, own it.
Well, also, I mean, I've watched you move to different parts of the country as well over that period of time.
You have.
Yeah. It's like, and there's something to be said for that. You know, if you buy a house in your kind of mid-20s and you live in, you know, say you buy in like the commuter belt, right, of London. Well, that's it. You're pretty much committed to living there.
Oh, yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
People do move across the country. They obviously sell homes and move to different parts of the country all the time. But it's not the same as being able to go, do you know what? I'm going to move to Harrogate.
Skipton.
I'm going to try living in Skipton.
I'm living in Manchester, and Newcastle, like, everywhere.
Yeah, and there's a lot to be said for experiencing different parts of the country in different cities and maybe deciding that you want to live there instead. There'll be people who have very good reasons for wanting to live in certain parts of the country. I mean, in my entire family and my wife's family all live in a certain part of the country. So it makes sense to kind of be in that part of the country because we like them. Yeah. And we do see them. And it's easier than if we lived at the other end of the country. But if I didn't have that, then, you know.
Yeah. Well, I've got family dotted around. But yeah, look, it's enabled me to do work that I wouldn't. One of the biggest criticisms we get as journalists in London is being London-focused journalists. And actually, I've spent much more of my career outside of London. And indeed, during sort of the pandemic era, I probably spent about 7 months in Spain, which, yes, you could argue I could have done that and rented out my house. I wouldn't have necessarily felt comfortable. But look, I had the freedom. I could do what I want. And I liked that. And that worked for me. So,
yeah. You know, and there are many people, you know, of the demographic who listen to this podcast. That, you know, there are many kind of, you know, professionals, young professionals, for example, who, you know, who would earn less working in Leeds, Manchester, Birmingham, Newcastle, Cardiff, Bristol, you know, Edinburgh, etc., than they would do in London, but would have a better quality of living if they were living in those places because they would be able to rent a home for less. Mm-hmm. If they wanted to buy, they'd be able to get a better home. It would have more space. It'd have a better garden. It'd have a better access to the countryside. You might, you might have a better environment to live in. You know, the quality of life that you can get is not directly related to the monetary sum of money that you were being paid.
Yeah.
And that there are many, many jobs that people could do, you know, in their industries and in their areas, and there might be better jobs in those areas. And I think that, you know, spending a period of time renting and trying out different places means there's a lot to be said for that.
I agree. Right, let's move on. The most popular age, we're going to talk about retirement now. The most popular age that we want to retire is 62. I thought that was quite modest. You know, if you're picking any age, why you pick 62? Maybe there's a bit of just, maybe I could do it by 62. However, the majority of us probably won't be able to do that. Most of us think that we will have to work longer than 62. And I think about a quarter of those people who asked for this research thought they would have to work until they literally drop, which is rather depressing. So what will it take to retire earlier? Simon Lambert, how far off are we?
Further than we think. Unfortunately, this is a Scottish Widows study, which said an additional 1.2 million people are now not on track for even the most basic retirement lifestyle. So it uses these industry standard measures that we talk about regularly, the Pension and Lifetime Savings Association study, PLSA, which looks at what people need for different levels of retirement. And for the most basic retirement, people need £14,400 for a single person, and £22,400 for a couple. But most people will be aspiring to a better or more comfortable retirement than that, which I will find you the numbers on. Right, for a moderate retirement, which is the one that I think most people would aspire to have as their baseline, a single person would need £31,300. And a couple would need £43,100. And for a comfortable retirement, a single person would need £43,100. And a couple would need £59,000. So this puts a, you know, some perspective on the numbers that we're aiming at here. It's the couples obviously benefit from their combined spending power, so it's not two times the individual. Yeah. And for everyone, it will be, you know, different. But you also need to remember that this is basically, these figures are post-tax and rely on you not having any rent to pay. So they basically work on the basis that people have paid off a mortgage. So factor that into play. Now, the good news is you've got your state pension. That's £11,500 a year per person. So to get to the single number, you need another £3,000 on top of it. But to get to the moderate number as an individual, you need another £20,000 on top of it. As a couple, also, for example, to get to the moderate level, you'd be getting £23,000 in full state pension between you, so you'd need another £20,000 on top. So you need to be saving. Now, the good thing is that people are saving, and they are saving from earlier in their life, largely thanks to auto-enrollment, nudging whichever it is, into saving for their pensions. And so hopefully we're going to have an entire generation of people who, even though they're relying on defined contribution pensions where they have to build up the pot and then invest it in retirement to provide themselves with their retirement income, did at least start doing that in their early 20s, and they're going to benefit from 40 years or 40 odd years of retirement saving. And the difference between saving for 30 years and 40 years is thanks to the miracle of compounding, doubling your money.
Nice.
So start early. Okay. And if you're self-employed, it's your responsibility. Yeah. You need to do this. Again, start early. It's even more important that you start early and keep it up. The bad news is that there are many people in the pensions industry who will tell you that, unfortunately, auto-enrollment doesn't provide enough.
Yeah.
It's 8% going into people's pensions at the moment, and really it needs to be 12. If they're starting in their early 20s, 12, probably okay. 15% better. There's a rule of thumb, to come back to our rules of thumb, which is half your age. So if you started at 24, you could get away with putting 12% in for the rest of your life. Don't worry, people. You don't have to keep going up with your age. It's not that you start putting in 12% when you're 24, and then when you reach 60, you're having to put 30% of your wages in. You just keep the same number the whole way through. If you start at 30, it's 15%. If you start at 40, it's 20%, and so on. It's not a bad rule of thumb. It does tend to work out. But there's a lot of pressure on Labour, actually, as part of this pensions review, and including our very own Steve Webb, who would like to see auto-enrolment pushed up to a higher number. People would like to see it pushed up to that 12 or 15. And that would then start to mean that people do reach the numbers that they need to.
Indeed. All right, Simon, finally, just because why not? There's loads of stats out there. And I can't say statistic that well. So it's time. I can't even say Simon now. Simon's stat of the week. I mean, I don't know if this is going to fly for a long time, but I just thought we'd throw this in. Why not, Simon? Have you got a good stat for me? I love a good stat.
I have got a good stat for you, Georgie. Okay, right. Here is a stat that regular listeners will recognise relates to something that drives me nuts.
Yep.
About our tax system, which is a very unfair bit of our tax system, which is the 60% tax rate.
Yep.
Basically, income tax rates in this country go 20%, 40%, 60%, 45%. No way to run a tax system.
Nope.
You shouldn't charge people 60% tax when they are not the highest earners. Okay. This relates to the removal of the personal allowance above £100,000, where, because it's removed at a 50p for every extra £1 you earn, it turns the 40p income tax rate into a 60% income tax rate. This is actually part of the income tax system, so it's not like where a benefit and a tax interact and you get a weird marginal rate. This is just a genuine part of the income tax system. 500,000 people are paying 60% tax on the next pound they earn. There are 500,000 people currently in that bracket between 100,000 and 125,150 a year who are paying that number. And it's actually worse than that, because the number of additional rate taxpayers has risen substantially. There are now 1.13 million additional rate taxpayers who pay 45p tax. So you can add those two numbers together.
Yeah.
So we've got 537,000 people paying 60% tax, added to 1.13 million who've gone all the way through the 60% tax bracket and are now paying 45% tax. So that is over 1.6 million people who are the biggest taxpayers in this country that we're really annoying by treating them unfairly. And I just don't think that's sensible.
Simon's
stat of the week.
Stat of the week. That's it for this week. You can keep up. I like that. We'll keep that. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk. Tell us what you think about any of this stuff. Tell us any of your tips for saving, investing, emergency pots, all that kind of stuff. And if you've got a contender for start of the week, you can email us too. Or ask us a question. podcast@thisismoney.co.uk. Tweet us at thisismoney or come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
I'm Lisa Kaplan from Charles Stanley Direct. I spent 15 years helping people understand their finances with clear, jargon-free language. People often ask me whether they have enough to retire, what to do about inheritance tax, or how best to invest. Often, it's a simple question that one of my expert team can answer straight away. And we would love to help you too. Contact us for a free 15-minute chat at coaching@charles-stanley.co.uk. Investment involves risk.